Let the record show that after massive electoral defeats, political parties always see if they can find their soul so that they can search it. And for the angst-ridden ALP, the political influence of the union movement is increasingly mentioned in post-defeat therapy sessions. Unions equals political poison. The corruption scandal in the health services union stalked federal Labor almost from the beginning to end, and there are now allegations that the Transport Workers Union has used slush funds to bankroll factional battles within the ALP. Now, within the US, similar concerns about the decline of union membership, what it means for politics, and involved in that debate are two American political scientists to join me now. Margaret Leaving is Professor of International Studies at the University of Washington and also Chair of Politics at Sydney University's US Studies Centre. John Olquist, Associate Professor of Political Science, University of Wisconsin-Madison. And their new book, In the Interest of Others, Organizations and Social Activism, is about two big unions, the American Longshoremen and their Australian equivalent, the Waterside Workers, the Wharfies. Margaret, unions in Australia at the moment are politically toxic and union leaders are not far behind. Is it similar with the union movement in the US?
Well, there have been some spectacular examples. You said that our book was about the longshore workers of the U.S., but it's actually about two different unions of the longshore workers. One is very much the On the Waterfront union, renowned for its corruption and its failures to serve its membership. And the other is the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which is just the opposite, has experienced virtually no corruption and has been extraordinary in its capacity to improve the welfare, health, well-being of its members, while also encouraging them to act in a variety of political ways in the interest of others.
Margaret, of those two, which union has been the most successful in recruiting or keeping members?
Well, membership in the U.S. is really very much on the basis of what work you do. And in both cases, the ports have gone up and down in reaction to trade, in international trade. So both of them, in some sense, have been successful in keeping members. But there have been many, many more rebellions against leadership within the East Coast International Longshore Association.
John, the old catch cry was workers of the world unite. But you write that American workers' movements being undermined by another form of global unity, companies moving their work offshore at will.
That's true. That's certainly been a point of contention within the American labor movement for quite some time. One of the chapters in the book, we talk about one of the things that makes the ILWU that Margaret mentioned so interesting is that they work at really the point of intersection with international markets and international trade. They're the ones loading and unloading ships, bringing the goods into and out of the United States. Same for the wharfies in Australia. And what's been really remarkable about the ILWU is that they have taken stands in many ways against at least the kind of standard mode of globalization and trade liberalization that we've seen being pursued by most Western and non-Western governments. And that's something that seems, from an outside observer's perspective, to be contrary to their immediate self-interest. But the union and the union members and the union leaders, to our research, don't seem to see it that way. They seem to see the way in which trade and trade negotiations proceeding as to not necessarily be in the interests of them or their children for the long term, and certainly not necessarily in the interests of workers in other places, either in the United States economy or abroad. And they've been acting on those beliefs repeatedly, and we found that to be quite puzzling and interesting, and we found it to be quite sincere.
It seems only yesterday I was talking with our American correspondent, Bruce Shapiro, reporting on that quite unprecedented protest in Wisconsin against anti-union legislation that took away public employee union rights to bargain, and as well as cutting pensions and wages. Now, a lot of us at the time thought this would be the new beginning for the labour movement in the US, but that new dawn didn't happen.
It certainly didn't. And that's a big area of discussion right now, and I don't think there's a short answer. The thing that we've talked about a lot and that's been written about a little bit is the big gap right now is the decline in private sector unions. And where you saw public sector unions becoming strong and powerful in the United States was in parts of the country where private sector workers had earned and defended the right to bargain collectively and have rights at work. And when those rights and those unions were eroded over time because of skill changes, technological changes, globalization, what have you, those unions, those workers no longer had those rights, those unions were gone, and now they turn to public sector workers who do have those rights, and they kind of turn, look, why do teachers and firefighters get to have these rights when I don't? I pay their salary as a taxpayer. So it's kind of this erosion that's driving this dynamic. So
But the American Federation, the AFL-CIO, yeah, has been attempting to counter that by introducing some new strategies, which will create coalitions between the labor unions and community partners, because there are a lot of community organizations. Now, whether that'll be successful is really up in the air.
I want to get into that shortly. At the moment, we are nonplussed by images of the protests against Walmart, for example, which treats unions not simply with hostility, but rage.
Yep.
And you look at this model, you look at this broken system, and you wonder how it could possibly endure.
Well, there is a serious question about that. I mean, I have argued for some time that the model of labor unions that was first created in the 19th century around craft unions was corrected in the 1930s by the industrial labor unions. We've seen some correctives in the 1960s and 70s with the efforts to organize service workers, which is a very different model of organization. And the Service Employees International Union in the U.S. has been the only one that's of the private sector unions. It's really seen significant growth because they've used a different kind of organizing model. But we're now in a different era, and what we lack, I think, in the union movement is the kind of creative, strategic energy. That doesn't mean it won't happen, but
and
I don't know
perhaps,
where it...
Perhaps we also lack absolutely charismatic leaders, which brings us back to the thesis of your book. One of the union leaders you look at is Harry Bridges, now, who was the head of the Longshoremen for many years, and he was, of course, an Australian from Melbourne who moved to the US as a young man. Does his style of leadership have any relevance today?
Well, I think it does, but let's parse that a little bit, because I think charisma, at least in terms of rhetoric and being a great speechifier, was the least of important of his attributes. The most important, really, was first that he was foundational in that he solved crucial strategic problems for a group of workers who were being treated abysmally.
For example?
Well, do you know where the term longshore presumably comes from? Well, it comes from the fact that the homeless men in the 1930s were sleeping on the beach, and the walking boss, the guy who would give out the jobs, would bellow out in the morning all along the shore, come in, there's some jobs to be given out, and then he would hand out the jobs.
A direct parallel with what happened with Wolfies here.
Absolutely. Same, it was the bull system in a different version. And the jobs were given out to those who would grease his palm or shared his politics or shared their wives or whatever it was that he particularly valued. It was extremely demeaning to the workers. And Harry Bridges and his cohort, it wasn't just Bridges, solved that problem. They figured out how to organize the workers, how to get a strike that was effective going, how to win initial collective bargaining rights. And then he used that moment, and this is what's crucial, and Big Jim Healey did the same thing, in Australia, they used it to create a constitution. They were the founding fathers, in this case, there were no mothers, who really created a constitution and a set of governance arrangements for the union that created rank-and-file democracy and a commitment to larger social goals.
Ellen L., RN, my guests are Margaret Levy and John Ulquist, and we're discussing their book, In the Interest of Others. Thinking of Harry, of course, means we've got to think of Jimmy Hoffa, head of the Teamsters. An observation on Hoffa's, well, the contrast, say, between Bridges and Hoffa.
I mean, so they had many parallels in the sense that they were actually both quite successful in solving these tactical and strategic problems for the workers they were tasked to represent. I think where they diverge is what their larger objectives were, and that's part of the argument in the book, is that becoming a leader, particularly of these unions at the time at which this occurred, was extremely dangerous, potentially risky, and hard. And people did not engage in this unless they also had other things that they wanted beyond just representing the workers. Harry Bridges had very strong political and social commitments that he acted on himself and was able to successfully bring the members along behind him on many occasions. Jimmy Hoffa did not. He had basically material and personal economic self-interests that he also wanted to serve, and he did that. And so our argument is that it's these distinctions between what motivates these individuals and then how that induces them to draw up, as Margaret mentioned, the constitutions and rules of the organization that let them continue to get what they want. And so for Bridges, it was restraining or putting himself at the service of the members and allowing himself to be checked in elections and to have his pay limited by constitutional rules that enabled him to bring the workers behind him on his political goals. For Hoffa, it was the opposite. He was very strong, centralized authority in his hands, and was able to win good contracts for the Teamster workers for the most part, but also was able to, you know, skim off the top for himself or to engage with, you know, actors outside the union. So the mob is kind of the most commonly referenced to get other things he wanted.
But first and foremost, both of those leaders, and Big Jim Healy as well, not the leaders of the ILA on the East Coast, but those three were really effective in serving the material interests of their workers, and they saw that as their first task. Before they could skim off the top in the case of Hoffa or Beck and Teamsters, or before they could demand political action, as was the case of Big Jim Healy and Harry Bridges.
There wasn't a lot of corruption at the top level of communist-run unions here.
No.
They were ideologically pretty pure. And as a consequence, you got a paradox, which was fascinating to observe, and that is that wharfies and their families living around the, you know, the areas in Melbourne, Port Melbourne, etc., would again and again and again vote for a communist trade union leader, but never if a communist ran for political office, you know, for parliament. They seem to make an interesting ideological distinction.
That's very interesting. I mean, there is nothing like that in the U.S. since throughout most of this period, communism was illegal. So you never had anybody run for office as a communist, and Harry Bridges had to deny.
Yeah.
And may never have joined the Communist Party. He would say, I believe in communism, but I'm not a member of the Communist Party.
John, coming back to the book, you look at political industrial actions like the wharfies, and longshoremen refusing to load scrap iron for Japan in the 1930s. That was a very significant dispute here in the U.S.?
In the U.S. as well, it was very, I mean, think about the time this was happening. This is 1938, 37. This is in the Roosevelt administration in the United States, who, you know, made his name in dealing with workers and with workers' unions and kind of was renowned as being the kind of political savior of the working class of the United States in some sense. And yet you had a group of left-wing unionists on their own accord taking foreign policy issues into their own hands, not consulting with the government and taking a very strong action. So it was very embarrassing for the Roosevelt administration.
Roosevelt called Bridges and said that you're interfering with an international issue. This is not your job. He said, we're Americans, which he wasn't actually at the time, but he said, we're American citizens. We have a right to whatever voice we want to express.
And, of course, very powerful political issues are imported and exported at every port, everywhere, throughout history.
Yeah.
What's important to retain from the past when considering the future, Margaret?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One, I think the lessons of these unions tell us a lot about not just unions, But one of the reasons that we both became very interested in studying these unions is that there are lessons in here about governance of organizations more generally. So by unraveling the past and looking at something that happens over 80 years, we're able to understand not just something that occurred, but also what sustains it over time, how you can create a constitution and a set of arrangements that will actually sustain themselves, and the bridges of the world and the Healy's of the world will die, but the union culture will continue, or the government culture will continue.
John, do the new technologies afford an opportunity for the union movement?
I'd say a guarded yes. I mean, part of it is the difficulty with new technology, especially at the pace we're seeing now, is it's extremely difficult to foresee what it's going to mean from a worker's perspective. The major technological change we looked at in the book was containerization of shipping, which happened at a much slower pace than a lot of what we're seeing now. And it was very, for the longshoremen and the wharfies, it was very clear what was going to happen, what it meant for them, what it meant for the number of workers on the docks, and so forth. And so they were able to, at least the ILWU was able to negotiate what they call the mechanization and modernization agreement. They were able to bargain with the employer to say, look, there's this new opportunity here. We're helping you take advantage of it, but we are not going to let you, the employer, get all the benefits of the new technology. We are going to share in it as well, and we're going to negotiate a piece of the machine, is what they called it. Now it's much more difficult to see where the benefits and costs are coming from. You see new technologies disrupting whole industries and firms that existed or have existed for many decades, and it's not clear, even if you could bargain over who gets the benefits of that, who you would bargain with and on what terms.
Look, that's a very useful argument. But I was trying to raise another issue, Margaret, and that is it possible to organize energetically now, given the new technologies?
Oh, I think it definitely is. The way in which people are organizing is changing. So I work very closely at the University of Washington, as John does at the University of Wisconsin, with a group of students who are the United Students Against Sweatshops. And they are incredibly effective at creating change with very small numbers. And they do that because of using the technology. They know how to use the internet. They know how to, really effectively, Twitter and all of the rest of that. They get their messages out through the new media in a way that just was, we didn't know how to do. I was part of the 60s movement. And we had a terrible time getting our messages out in the way we wanted them framed, and these students seem to know how to do that. So I think there are things the union movement could learn from them, and other movements could learn from them, about ways in which to take even a small number of intensely dedicated people and create a message that then is bought by committees and groups and others who can actually make change.
I guess the one thing to add to that is kind of the question of what do you mean by organize? We're looking at, in the United States, labor law that was developed and effectively has not changed since the 1930s.
Right.
Whereas what a job means, who owns it, if you want to put it in those terms, has changed dramatically. And when you, professor of economics at Harvard, Freeman, has done a lot of really interesting work basically asking what do workers want on the job? And workers want some predictability. They want a say on the job. They don't want to feel like they're giving up all their own personal autonomy and human rights just because they have a wage. And any organization and mechanism that lets them do that, they seem to be willing to tolerate and support. And it may not look like a union looks under American labor law from the 1930s. And trying to understand how you would then organize in those terms, given the new structure of work where people are working from home a lot, they work on off hours from each other, they may not see each other as much. All of these things that we saw as very important in the longshore workers for developing and maintaining their organization become much more difficult under the new working situations. And that's a challenge that the new technology may, in fact, be able to address.
Look, thank you both very, very much. Margaret Leaving. John Olquist, their book, very dense, very intense, and absolutely fascinating, is In the Interest of Others, Organizations and Social Activism, and it's published by Princeton University Press. Very eclectic mob of universities. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.